Hello, I'm Goldie Sayers, Olympian and former javelin thrower. And welcome back to Insider, the podcast from the UK Sports Institute that lifts the lid on the science behind peak performance. Whether you're an elite sports person looking for advice, a coach seeking to learn more, or you're a weekend warrior who just wants to understand what's happening to your body, we've got a podcast for you. As we continue our series exploring women's health and peak performance, in this episode we're exploring hormones and how they can affect the female body, especially at different times of the month. Earlier in this series, we did an episode all about the menstrual cycle. We know that the better an athlete can get to know their period and symptoms, the better they can use this information to help aid their training and performance. However, there are so many apps out there. How do athletes know which they should use? And why do they even need to do this in the first place? Then there's contraception. Yes, this can control periods and help with some of the more unpleasant side effects, but can this interfere with performance? Let's find out. It's a very warm welcome back to the podcast to Richard Burden, co-lead of Female Athlete Health and Performance. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Goldie.
And hello for the first time to Kirsty Elliott Sale, Professor of Female Endocrinology and Exercise Physiology. Rich, regular listeners to this series will remember you from our previous episode, but they do not know Kirsty, whose bio I have read, and there is no high level educational institution that you've not lectured or been a professor in. So, Kirsty, give us the top line on your role and background and explain how you work with the UK Sports Institute.
Absolutely. So firstly, thank you for my invitation to come on the podcast. Okay, me in a nutshell, I've had the privilege of working in the female athlete space for around 25 years now, which makes me old. So I was fortunate to do my PhD in this area, and I've continued, as I say, in this space since then. I research things like menstrual cycles, hormonal contraception, a little bit around low energy availability in female athletes, pregnancy, all of the really nice topics that you've already covered and mentioned, things that really impact or have the potential to impact upon female athletes, their health and their performance. And yeah, I'm currently, as you said, a professor at Manchester Metropolitan University at the somewhat newly formed Institute of Sport there, which is really exciting. And one of our sort of main pillars of research, one of our main themes is around women in sport. And we're really fortunate that we have a really great partnership with UKSI. So we're the people behind the scenes doing some research, both in our labs, but also trying to facilitate research in the field. So directly with female athletes in their place, in their space. And, you know, it's really important that we get their input, because otherwise it can feel like quite a gap between what we might do in a laboratory versus what is the reality in elite sport.
And Kirsty, why do we encourage athletes to monitor their cycle, and how would you kind of recommend they do that?
Oh, great question. I think they should monitor their cycles at least initially, so that they can understand if they're affected by these sort of fluctuations in estrogen and progesterone that occur across the cycle, to see if they're influenced by that. Of course, some athletes will not be influenced. And if they're not, then they can stop tracking and they can concentrate on sort of other aspects that underpin sort of health and performance. But if athletes track their cycles and they notice either that they have symptoms which occur in a particular phase of their cycle, so the recurrent symptoms, or if they notice that maybe an aspect of their health or performance is affected again on a regular basis. So it's a repeating pattern. You can't tell from just tracking one cycle. But if you've been tracking your cycle and your performance and health for maybe 3 to 6 months, if you notice a pattern there, then of course you can leverage that information. So if it's something that is negative, for example, then you can look to put an intervention in there to mitigate those adverse effects. But of course, sometimes we forget that there will be some good phases and, you know, some really good opportunities to, again, leverage a time in your cycle when you feel great. Because, you know, we really should remember that world records or World Cup finals, whatever it might be in any sport, have been, you know, achieved on all of the days of the menstrual cycle. So I think it's important that by tracking and by becoming really body literate, you can either determine if you are affected, if so, you know, good times, bad times. And also if you're not affected, I think that's really important, because it means then that, as I say, you can sort of leave that behind and move on to other things.
And Rich, what sort of things have you noticed athletes looking out for and kind of noting down within their cycles?
Yeah, so I mean, some of the most basic things is, for those athletes that aren't on any hormonal contraception, is whether they're having a period or not. So we would encourage athletes to note down the first day of their period and have an idea of how many days they're bleeding for, and then when their next period starts. So from that, they can understand, firstly, whether they're having a period and how long their period is lasting for, but then also the gap between the first day of one period and the first day of the next period gives them an idea of how long their menstrual cycle is. And, you know, the average menstrual cycle is 28 days. So they can start to understand a little bit more about their own kind of menstrual health just by noting down those two things. And the other thing that basic kind of monitoring of their menstrual status does, and Kirsty already mentioned body literacy, but athletes start to be able to connect the physiology of their menstrual cycle with the perceptions and how they feel during those different phases of their menstrual cycle. So they can kind of start to connect the biology with their kind of lived experience. And once they can start to understand that a little bit better, that can actually lead to better conversations with the people around them, whether it's fellow athletes or whether it's practitioners or whether it's their coaches. The more they understand about themselves, the more confident they feel to be able to talk about some of these things that may lead to kind of better performance discussions or health discussions with those around them.
And other than the sort of communication and conversations within teams and with practitioners, perhaps, what else can they do about their menstrual cycle if they start to identify patterns?
So the conversation around them goes into kind of more proactive support. So, you know, if they are tracking symptoms, for example, and they are noting down symptoms that they experience from one cycle to the next, that gives them the ability and those supporting them the ability to be proactive with kind of any interventions that may be deemed relevant. So, for example, if someone is suffering with pains in the premenstrual syndrome, for example, or PMS, then that is something that can be acted upon proactively, and it's not something that an athlete has to suffer through. So if it's been identified that actually the pains that they are suffering are related to PMS, then medication can be proactively kind of delivered rather than kind of reactive.
And Kirsty, when we talk about PMS or PMT, what's actually happening to us in that phase? Is it a real thing? I mean, I know it's a real thing. And can we kind of plot when it might strike as well?
Yes, to all of those questions. Yes, it is a real thing. So those symptoms are caused by, I'm going to go all science geeky here, I promise to keep it light. It's because the two hormones, estrogen and progesterone, are basically on their way down to their lowest point. So they peak sort of in the, I'm going to say, the latter third of the cycle. And once they've reached sort of the high points, then they start to decline rapidly. And when they hit their lowest point, that's when the athlete gets her period again. And so it's that decline in those two hormones, the rapid decline, that causes, or can cause in some, but not all, these sort of symptoms of PMS. So yes, it's absolutely a real thing. And a little bit like I said earlier, some athletes don't get it, some women don't get it, but that doesn't make it not a real thing. What we need to make it clear is that menstrual cycle tracking, if you notice a pattern or you notice that in that sort of PMS phase, so that sort of 4 or 5, unfortunately for some, maybe 6 or 7 days before they get their period, that they get a lot of symptoms, and those symptoms can maybe negatively affect performance. Of course, we can't change the Olympic final. You know, we can ring up and say, not a good phase for me, please change it. But what we can do is exactly as Rich described, by having that information, by doing this type of tracking work in advance of an Olympic final or whatever sort of an athlete's big competition is, then we can be proactive. We can get in those interventions. We can trial some interventions and find out which one works best for that particular athlete. And the goal here is, you know, to make sure that the athletes who are suffering, whether it's in that sort of phase of PMS or other phases, that they never reach those low points, that we keep them sort of buoyant. Because the whole thing around, you know, whether you're tracking menstrual cycles or you're doing a piece, some consideration about maybe your hormonal contraceptive use, the idea is to empower female athletes to be able to perform at their highest level, regardless of what their, you know, reproductive hormones are doing. So we just want to be able to, you know, level out so that they're not adversely affected. And of course, really, you know, sort of leverage when they feel good. And again, sort of maximize, particularly training in those phases when they feel good, push on a little bit more, because then it balances out a time when maybe they don't feel 100%.
So Kirsty, we've talked a lot about apps, and there's obviously a huge number of free apps that you can download. Do you see the benefit of those, and do they actually work?
Okay, so I think that athletes can probably do something by themselves without some of these sort of systems that are commercially available. Going back to what Rich said earlier on, the first thing they need to do is note down when they get their period. And so we don't need anything for that. Just put an X on the calendar. And then if you put an X on the calendar for when you get your next period, then we can work out your cycle length. And as Rich said, the average cycle length is 28 days. And we're comfortable if your cycle length is anywhere between 21 and 35 days. But if it's less than 21 or more than 35, then we might sort of signpost an athlete to just to get that checked out with a medical professional. So that's the first thing that you need to track. And that's very easy to do without any technology. And here's where I think athletes can really supersede anything that's available right now. So I think the next thing they need to do is maybe check to see if they're ovulating. Now, that sounds very specific. It's very easy to do. There are urinary ovulation detection kits. Again, fancy word, it means that you urinate on a little stick and it gives you, for example, the ones I use give a smiley face when you ovulate. So it's very easy to use that. And that's really useful information because, again, it gives us a second sort of milestone within your menstrual cycle. It's an extra marker of health. It means that your hormones are fluctuating as expected. So that's really, really good news. And, you know, currently any of the technologies available right now that are designed or purported to track menstrual cycles, they don't do that. It's something that an athlete has to do themselves. So it's marking an X on the calendar for when you get your period. It's using these ovulation kits that are urine-based for a few days and during the middle of your cycle to try and check if you're ovulating. And then if you want to sort of go all in for menstrual cycle tracking, now here's the bit some athletes don't like. We would normally take a blood sample about 7 days after that sort of confirmation of ovulation. And that blood sample, in that we would measure your concentration of progesterone. And there's a threshold. So if it's above the threshold, everything is great. And again, it gives us another marker of health. And again, you only have to do that once, maybe twice, to establish progesterone. You don't need to do that every month. And then those three things, as I say, give us a sense of whether or not that menstrual cycle is, one, healthy, two, acting like it should do, so with the right, you know, hormones going up and down at the right times. And three, by having those, then we can really start to chop that menstrual cycle into phases. Those phases are then what we call verified. Current technologies, some of these sort of apps and systems that you mentioned at the start, they don't verify phases, and they predict phases based on bleeding patterns. But of course, by doing that, you can't tell if they're ovulating, you can't tell if they've got the right progesterone, because they're hidden types of menstrual dysfunction. And so therefore, quite a long answer, but hopefully it makes sense. But I think these are the type of tracking systems we need to use, rather than relying on sort of predictions. And again, just thinking about those apps, really, if you really sit down and think about it, the athlete tells the app when they're bleeding. So, you know, it's not telling them when they're bleeding. So why not just take complete ownership and start to upgrade these tracking systems into something that's very meaningful, and moving from maybe predictions and estimations into something that's verified. And of course, athletes love data. And that's the type of data that we're looking for.
And it sounds, Kirsty, like the ovulation period is obviously very important. But do you see a performance kind of spike during that period? You know, I know your PhD from my extensive research was examining the effects of female reproductive hormones on muscle strength. Was that an interesting kind of insight around kind of peak performance within the cycle?
Yeah, I mean, that was a I'm such a nerd. I loved doing my PhD. Long story short, I did. I measured muscle function across the menstrual cycle, where there are, I would say, sort of subtle and acute changes. So hormones, yes, they do undulate and go up and down, but it happens quickly and they're not extreme changes. I also tested muscle function using hormonal contraceptives. And I also did something which is a little unusual, but I think it's worth noting before I tell you the findings. I also tested muscle function under very severe changes in estrogen and progesterone. A little bit random, had to use a sort of a medical model to do that, but we were able to change these hormones to what we call super physiological levels, so way bigger than any athlete would experience during her menstrual cycle. And here's for the findings. When we changed hormones across the menstrual cycle with oral contraceptive pills or under these extreme, what we call super physiological conditions, we didn't notice any changes in muscle function, which is, I think, a good finding in the sense of that allows female athletes not to stress and worry, oh my goodness, you know, I'm in this ovulatory phase or whichever phase it might be. I wonder is, you know, am I absolutely destined to have worse muscle function? I would say certainly from the findings of my PhD and since then, you know, specifically talking about muscle function, we're not really seeing notable changes. There isn't a phase where we say it's great here, it's bad here. But for full transparency, there are conflicting findings. If you were to do a deep dive, I know all athletes are dying to do a deep dive into research evidence, but you will find conflicting papers out there. But what I would say is just exercise a little bit of caution and maybe try and look at those papers and see, okay, are they good quality papers? Might be tricky for some to do, but of course, that's why researchers like me are out there, and anybody can ever get, you know, more than welcome to get in touch with me and say, I read this, what do you think? Is it credible? Should we implement this into practice?
And talking of apps, Rich, can you talk to me about the work you've been doing with an app called Hormonix? Because this is really changing the landscape for female athletes, isn't it?
Yeah, so I mean, it's basically a summary of what Kirsty mentioned about what current monitoring apps or tracking apps do. It's also really important to acknowledge what they don't do. And the one thing that they don't do is monitor what the hormones are actually doing. Okay, so kind of current approaches or current apps, you'll indicate when your period has started and you'll indicate when your next period has started to give you a menstrual cycle length. You know, if it fits in with the, you know, the average 28 days or between 21 and 35, it makes the assumption that all is well. But there are many circumstances that athletes experience where they might be having a period and they might be having a normal menstrual cycle length. Actually, the hormones are not cycling in the way that they should be cycling to truly represent a positive menstrual health. And so back in 2016, pretty much as soon as the Rio Paralympic Games finished, we had conversations with a company who were looking to develop ways of non-invasively measuring hormones. So, you know, Kirsty mentioned blood tests. And yeah, if you can get an athlete to do a blood test, that's great. But not all athletes like having a needle stuck into their arm. And particularly if you wanted to measure hormones in high frequency, that would mean doing blood tests fairly regularly. And there aren't many people that like doing that. And so we started to develop a way of measuring hormones in saliva rather than blood. So we could start to understand the individual differences in menstrual cycles because we were able to take samples more frequently. The athletes are able to do it themselves. They don't need a qualified practitioner to take blood. They can, you know, they can dribble into a tube in their own home and pop it in their own freezer. And so what that has allowed us to do is to really explore the individual nature of menstrual cycles, because the other thing that kind of broadly speaking, monitoring apps assume is that they are assuming that everyone is the same. Not everyone is the same. One size does not fit all. You know, we know that there's a high variability in menstrual cycles between individuals and within individuals from one cycle to the next. So when we're talking about elite athletes, like we really need to understand the individual. We need to understand why athlete A is different from athlete B. Like generalizations in this respect in elite sport don't really work. So we really needed to start to understand individuals and how individual menstrual cycles were being influenced by the sport and how the sport was influencing individual menstrual cycles.
And has the Hormonics app uncovered anything interesting? Have you got any athlete examples, perhaps?
Yeah, so it's allowed us to explore menstrual health and the influence of sport in ways that we weren't previously kind of able to. So, you know, we've used it most in athletes who have been challenged by menstrual irregularities kind of in the past or who are recovering from menstrual irregularities to try and understand how far off optimal menstrual health they are. So for example, we've had athletes who have had a history of amenorrhea because of relative energy deficiency. Okay, so they've been energy deficient for a really long time. And so to cut a long story short, that's essentially switched off their reproductive hormones. And so they go through a recovery process whereby, you know, it may be an intervention related to their training, or it may be nutritional strategies are implemented to correct the energy deficiency with the hope that that will then correct their menstrual irregularities. And what we've seen is that the individuals that are coming out of REDS start to get their periods back and start to have a normal menstrual cycle length. And without monitoring hormones, you'd kind of give them the thumbs up and the all clear, because their periods have come back, their menstrual cycle length has returned to kind of normal. Like the outward appearance of optimal menstrual health is there. But actually, by monitoring the hormones, we've been able to see that despite the appearance of optimal menstrual health, hormones still haven't returned to cycling in the way that they should. And so that then leads to more informed conversations about what support the athlete needs moving forward in order to support their return to training, support their general overall health and well-being.
Great. And what are some of the live projects that are going on within the UKSI in certain sports? I believe there's some projects in rowing and hockey happening at the moment.
Yeah. So, and this kind of also speaks to our collaboration with Kirsty and the Institute of Sport at Manchester Met. We're kind of trying to do things slightly differently, which we're trying to bring the research into and the researchers into the athlete's environment. Because what previously and what historically has happened is that, you know, elite sport athletes and coaches are over this side and researchers are in their labs over that side. And everyone's making guesses about what's important to each other. And, you know, the athletes will do their thing. Researchers will do their thing. And then we'll try and translate the two. And it doesn't really work because you know, sometimes the elite sport is a little bit skeptical about what's happening in research. Research doesn't really understand the context and the environment that the athletes have to compete in and live in on a daily basis. So for us to be able to produce really kind of translatable, transferable, really valuable information that's going to impact on the athletes and the coaches and the sport in general, we kind of need to bring the two together. And so what we've been doing in rowing in particular, it's a really good example of this. So rowing have been on the journey of a project that they've called Minerva with their female rowers for some time. And they kind of, they've collaborated with UKSI and now Manchester Met to ensure that the work that they are doing is as rigorous and robust as it possibly could be, given the constraints of doing research in an elite environment, so that the output, the information is as high quality and is as valuable as possible. So Kirsty spent time with rowing. We've got a PhD student called Glenn that is part of the project. Like he's kind of immersing himself in rowing. So meeting the coaches, meeting the athletes, having really good conversations with them and the support staff, so that we're all on the journey together. It's not sport happening one side, research happening the other side. Like everyone's in it, everyone's in the journey and, you know, following the same path. And the idea is that because of that, it's always being informed by the people it needs to be informed by, i.e. the athletes and the coaches, but it's being delivered with kind of expert knowledge, scientific rigor, to ensure that the information and the output of this research is as valuable and as meaningful as possible.
Would you say it's about bloody time there, Rich, to take a menstrual cycle pun, that we've finally, you know, got ourselves together and are delivering something that's, you know, noteworthy and athlete facing?
Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't sound like much, kind of bringing research and, you know, three organisations, so British Rowing, UKSI, Manchester Met. We all have different areas of expertise and we all have different things we can bring to the table. And it doesn't sound like a massive step change bringing those three things together, but it really is, because it doesn't happen often. And sometimes it's a bit of a struggle to make it happen. But Rowing have been excellent. They've been really open to it. They've been really honest and open in what they want to achieve, and really welcoming in the expertise that we might be able to bring, that Kirsty and Glenn bring. And it's the way forward.
Amen to that.
And Kirsty, have you noticed coming out of the lab, not that you spend every minute of every day, I'm sure, in a lab, but coming out of the lab and into an elite training environment, have you perhaps noticed any difference in how elite athletes experience periods compared to, I don't know, perhaps a control group, or I want to say normal and inverted commas people experience their cycles?
Absolutely, 100%. For a large portion of my career, I was just, you know, based in the lab, based in academia, you know, sort of doing my own thing and hoping that somebody was reading those papers I was putting out and that somebody would make, you know, that translational gap that Rich spoke about. And now that, you know, people like Rich and sports like British Rowing have allowed me the absolute privilege to go and, you know, work directly with them and talk to the athletes directly and to the sort of practitioners, it's been eye-opening, really. You know, I guess maybe a couple of quick examples I can give you is that, from a science perspective, it doesn't seem very burdensome to me to, you know, mark on the calendar when you get your period, you know, urinate, wee on a stick, you know, not to be too fine about it, but, you know, wee on a stick a few days per month and have a blood sample. But actually, when you see that amongst the reality of everything that athletes are asked to do and expected to do and everything they do as part of their daily life, you know, that really sort of stopped me in my tracks and thought, okay, this isn't necessarily always an easy lift into elite sport. And that's why I think the harmonic system is, you know, it's got great utility, that actually if you've got a system, and it reminds you as well, you know, I don't know if Rich mentioned that the system reminds you to please give your sample, and doing that, sort of providing that sample every other day, you know, seems a little less invasive, you know, and easier for some athletes to do. So that was one thing, you know, looking at alternative models. How can we modify it to make that fit into sport and still deliver something that's very high quality? And I guess the other thing that was really notable to me is that, and again, I'm going to use your phrase, normal women, women who are not athletes, and I'm so sorry if that's indelicate, but non-athletic women, maybe we'll put it like that, you know, we talk to them about their symptoms and the impact of that. And what I noticed was that with elite female athletes, they may be having similar symptoms, maybe even more severe. But some female athletes have an uncanny ability to, you know, their resilience is incredible, and that they still go out and train and compete despite, you know, some maybe suboptimal, you know, well-being feelings. And so seeing that, hearing about that, understanding their lived experiences has been really insightful as well, so that we can look at how best do we capture symptoms, how do we really look at severity, and again, what interventions and systems and processes we can put in place so that they don't have to do that. Just because they sometimes can overcome it doesn't mean that they should. So really lots of great insights from working directly with the athletes, and I have been absolutely blown away by their willingness to discuss these issues. I have to admit, I get a little cross. Sometimes I see in the media that, you know, this is a taboo topic in elite sport. That certainly has not been my experience. I think female athletes really get it. They see menstrual cycles, reproductive health as another component of sport. You know, we're comfortable talking about how we sleep, how we eat and so on. And they really see the value of these conversations. So I think, again, that's been something that's really, really good. And if maybe I can have one more point, sorry, super long answer. One thing that I've also noticed is that there's a real desire for female athletes to learn in this space and you know, educate themselves and be led by high quality research and all of this. They're really interested and invested in things like the menstrual cycle. But I think there's maybe a piece of work to do around, how do I put it? So they want this, but then when faced with what, you know, what it takes to be involved in a research study, maybe some back off a little bit and go, gosh, you know, that's a lot. And maybe I don't have capacity for this. And it, again, it's finding that really optimal way of working together where they get what they need, but can also take part in a way that's reasonable and not too burdensome for them. You know, we see athletes in the media saying, we need more research, and it's just matching that up with then their expectations of what that involves to be part of the research. Because if they're not part of the research, then we're in a vicious cycle, aren't we? We can't give evidence-based practice if we don't get the athletes to take part. So we really want to co-design research studies that are doable for them and still high quality and meaningful from a research perspective.
Fantastic. And Kirsty, there will be a number of female athletes who will be on a form of hormonal contraception like the pill. And what impact does that have on training and performance that you've seen?
Okay, so again, probably going to answer this from two perspectives. So the research perspective is quite quick. So the research perspective being when we sort of test in a lab performance under different sort of hormonal contraceptive conditions. So whether that's pill taking versus pill free days or so on, we don't tend to see a big change in performance. So, for example, a recent paper that we published showed no significant, and I'm talking about statistical significance, and we won't go into that. That's a bit deep. But we're not seeing this statistical significant difference between pill taking and pill free days, for example, which again is great news for a female athlete. It's one less thing to worry about. Where I guess the second perspective comes in is more around, again, symptomology. I would say that if you're an athlete who has a lot of menstrual cycle symptoms, so, you know, has a bad experience with their menstrual cycle, then I think hormonal contraceptives, you know, can level that out and get rid of those symptoms. And ergo, then they can train and compete better in that respect, because it gives them back, you know, that sense of health and well-being. So I think that that's one other way to look at it. I think that in elite sport, we sometimes, you know, our conversations around hormonal contraceptives are often obscure. So I think the first thing to remind everybody is hormonal contraception, by virtue of its name, is there for athletes as a contraceptive. And, you know, if we're talking about maybe subtle differences in performance, potential subtle differences in performance in a menstrual cycle or in pill taking versus pill free days, I can promise you that an unexpected pregnancy will definitely result in a change of performance. So we must always remind everybody in this space that it's a personal choice. It's a woman's choice. You know, it's a female athlete's choice to use contraception for contraceptive purposes. As I say, the second reason they might use them, which might have an indirect sort of health and performance outcome, is if they use it because they have very bad menstrual cycles and it helps them, then it gets rid of those symptoms. The third way we tend to talk about them in elite sport is maybe more around maybe some female athletes using hormonal contraceptives to get rid of, to bypass having their period as part of the menstrual cycle. Now, again, this is, you know, really very much down to the individual. And I can very much imagine, although I've never been an Olympic athlete, that, you know, perhaps getting your period on the Olympic final is, you know, yeah, that is disruptive. And, you know, we do hear about athletes using hormonal contraceptive for that reason. So in a way to manipulate the natural menstrual cycle and sort of overlay this hormonal contraceptive cycle. Now, again, that is very much down to the individual. I think maybe there's little things to consider around if you're not using it for contraception purposes, you know, and you do use it to manipulate your cycle, maybe don't do it all the time. You know, you can allow yourself to come off that, you know, in times when you don't need to, and back to the sort of natural menstrual cycle, which would be a woman's sort of default setting sort of post puberty right up until the menopause. So I think there's always with me a long answer. There's lots of different ways to look at it. Top line, from a research perspective, you don't need to really stress. We're not seeing it as an advantage or disadvantage. Just consider it more around your health, around your lifestyle, and around sort of, you know, what you need for contraception.
And it's, is there...
Hopefully that made sense.
But absolute sense. But is there a maximum number of months that you should maybe use the pill back to back that you would recommend?
No, so there's nothing like that. I think obviously what we need to consider, again, from maybe taking a step back from maybe more a medical perspective, you know, oral contraceptive pills or long-acting reversible contraceptives, so things like the injections and so on, they're absolutely safe to use. You know, women away from sport use them for, you know, a long number of years throughout adulthood. So there's no real concern there. I guess what we're just more saying is if you're not using it for contraceptive purposes and, you know, you've gone maybe three pill packets back to back without a withdrawal bleed, what we're saying is, you know, if you want to return to a more sort of natural, and again, I sort of, it's quite nuanced, so I hope that people will get the nuance here, but if you just want to go back to just removing those exogenous hormones and going back to sort of just changes in the natural endogenous, we're going to say sort of internal hormones, then we would always say that's a good thing, that's a healthy thing. But we're certainly, whilst we're saying that's a healthy thing, we're not saying that, you know, extended use is not healthy. But it's just sort of saying to people, if you don't need it all the time, then don't use it all the time. And actually, that's probably just good life advice, isn't it, for women in a wider sort of sense.
And very briefly, are there any other forms of contraception that you'd encourage athletes particularly to maybe think about using?
Ooh, what I would say is, no is the answer. Sorry, I missed out the important part. No, I don't have a preferential one. I would say it very much depends on, you know, that female athlete's lifestyle. So some people really like, they take the pill and it means that if they want to stop, they literally just stop the next day, you know, and so it's very much under their control. Of course, taking the pill, for example, does rely on you to remember to do it every day, and that isn't good for some athletes. They've got a lot of other things to consider. And so therefore, they might look at something that's more long acting so that they don't have that sort of daily load. And when you think about it, we've got things that are daily, like the pill, weekly, like maybe the hormonal patch, so it's less sort of need to remember that, and then we go into weeks, months and sort of years with some of the long acting ones. So I would say that just choose the one that fits in best with you, your lifestyle, whether it's a remembering thing or maybe your sport, you know, doesn't lend itself well to you know, withdrawal bleeds, and you need longer sort of portions of time without any withdrawal bleeds. So again, you look for something that's long acting and doesn't have a sort of monthly schedule bleed. So yeah, really down to individual choice. One thing I think is very important to say is that we have noted that some female athletes end up taking a hormonal contraceptive because it's the one they've been given, one they've been prescribed. And again, this is not a criticism of any medical doctor, but they get one that they're prescribed, they take it, and they're telling us they've got lots of symptoms, or, well, they call them symptoms, but actually they're side effects. It's a side effect of that particular contraceptive. I know it seems very obvious, but this, you know, doesn't happen often. Go back and ask to try a different one. And we have noticed that, you know, women in general, and again, in the elite sort of female athlete space, they just tend to persevere with the one they were prescribed. So what I would say is, whilst I don't have one that is preferential, I would say that female athletes do need to do a little bit of work around what is preferential for them. So if they're finding that they're still getting a lot of side effects with one, then why not swap to another one? You know, that is under our control. Sort of symptoms with the menstrual cycle are less under our control, but side effects of hormonal contraception is. So I would encourage athletes to, you know, road test a few different ones. And again, just being really clear, doing that away from major competition, probably not best to try one the day before. And again, working that in the same way that we talk about, you know, doing pockets of time where you track your cycle so you get that body literacy, and then you can use that over time in your practice. It's the same with hormonal contraception. Think, you know, check in with yourself. Is this working for me? Is this the right one for me? And not being afraid to go back and say, can I try something different?
Brilliant. And before I let you both go, can I get your top tips for understanding how hormones might be affecting us and our performance? Rich, I'll start with you.
Okay, so I'm going to spin it on its head. And I think Kirsty mentioned this a little bit earlier on during the conversation, but we spend a lot of time talking about symptoms with negative connotations. How are symptoms of the menstrual cycle impeding your ability to train or to perform? Whereas, and we don't spend anywhere near enough time, and you know, I include myself in the we here, talking about the potential positives. So we rarely ask the questions like, how confident do you feel today? Or how strong do you feel today? I think we need to be doing that more. I think we need to start to take note of the times when athletes are feeling good. And in the same way that we might, you know, track longitudinally to see if there are any patterns there for kind of negative symptoms, why don't we do the same for positive symptoms?
And Kirsty, top tips on understanding your hormones.
Oh, how do you better that one? That was a good one. You stole my one.
That's why I got in first.
And of course, now you've all realised I'm such a talker. I'm so Irish. I have two. I've got to make them quick. I think one is being open-minded, keeping an open mind, and it goes back to one of my very first points. Be open-minded as an athlete. I might not be affected by these fluctuations, and that's all good. And if I am affected, exactly as Rich said, acknowledge the positives just as much as you may have the negatives. So be open-minded. And my second one is ownership. Although I absolutely do not want to add to the burden of female athletes, I do think that this is something that an athlete, in most ways, with support, don't get me wrong, from those around them, but in the most, I think it's something we have to do for ourselves. So we do have to take ownership of, you know, noting down when we get our period, maybe doing those ovulation tests, maybe the blood test or the every other day saliva samples. And it's an investment. And I would argue it's really, really worthwhile, because that level of body literacy is incredible. And we don't want to see athletes in the media saying, I feel like, you know, today didn't go my way because of this. It would be great to say, today things went my way because I understand my body. I know when things are great. I know when things are not quite right. And I invested in myself to get ahead of that, to put in those interventions, to mitigate those, maximize the gains. And I'm all good. Here I am smashing it. Absolutely at my potential. So yeah, they're the two things I would say.
Fantastic. And now we're all off to read every article you've ever written, Kirsty, on the female menstrual cycle, no doubt. But thank you both very much.
At least have a big coffee if you are.
Yeah. It'd be bedtime reading, couldn't it? To aid our sleep and performance.
Absolutely.
Brilliant. Thanks for joining me. If you enjoyed that episode and found it useful, then there's plenty more to come in this special series on female athlete health and performance. So if you haven't already, why not give this podcast a follow so you don't miss an episode? And if you want to carry on the conversation or get in touch with a topic you'd like us to cover, let us know. Find us on social media, UK Sports INST on Twitter and Instagram. I'll be back soon with another podcast when we'll be discussing the importance of a good sports bra. Did you know that proper breast support can actually make you a better athlete? We'll unpack more fascinating insights from the UKSI on the next episode of Insider. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch up soon.